From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Arrest Records and the expanding movement to ban the box. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After 20 years of being tough on crime, local cops have arrested almost one-third of all Americans. Their records are easily available to banks, college officials, and prospective employers, even when their crimes were minor or they were never charged. Now, 60 cities and 12 states have laws that ban the box on application forms asking, "Have you ever been arrested?" We'll hear what that means for the individuals involved, for employers fearing lawsuits for making mistakes, and for public safety. Today's talking point, Islamic terrorism in Iraq, homegrown in Britain. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Target, Walmart, and Bed Bath & Beyond are among the companies that no longer ask job applicants if they've ever been arrested. We'll hear why the Ban the Box movement is spreading across the country. Today's talking point, the masked executioner of American journalist James Foley had a London accent. We'll hear how Britons are coping with the role of their countrymen in a vicious form of terrorism. First, this news update. Dr. Kent Brantley, the medical missionary who contracted Ebola in West Africa, was released today from the infectious disease unit at Emory University in Atlanta. He told reporters he was thrilled to be alive.
Through the care of the Samaritan's Purse and SIM missionary team in Liberia, the use of an experimental drug, and the expertise and resources of the healthcare team at Emory University Hospital, God saved my life.
Dr. Bruce Ribner, the director of the infectious disease unit, announced Brantley's release with reassuring words about what he called a rigorous course of treatment and testing.
Dr. Brantley has recovered from the Ebola virus infection and that he can return to his family, to his community, and to his life without public health concerns.
Akiko Kitamura is a health and science reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us from London, where she's worked with colleagues in the U.S., in West Africa, and in Geneva, which is headquarters of the World Health Organization. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Good to be here.
Do we know that this means full recovery, that organ damage won't be a problem in later life or other manifestations of this disease?
As we heard on the press conference today, Dr. Ribner did say that he was citing past experience with Ebola patients who had recovered in West Africa, and he was careful to say that once a survivor has recovered, they're not contagious, they don't relapse, they don't spread the disease, and generally they don't carry the virus. So it seems like, based on past experience, he should be fine.
He should be fine for the rest of his life, then. He is fully recovered?
They say there's no evidence otherwise, yes.
We heard mention of an experimental drug. That means ZMapp, the drug that is manufactured in Kentucky. I understand the supplies are exhausted.
Yes. This was an experimental drug that's only been tested in primates, and so it's still in a very experimental phase, and so they had not ramped up production for widespread use. So they've tried this drug on Dr. Brantley and Nancy Reipel, and they've also sent it to Nigeria and Liberia for some healthcare workers there. So after those doses were sent, the supply has been exhausted now.
You mentioned the name of the other doctor who came here to Atlanta with Dr. Brantley, and she has asked that she not be made to appear in public. We don't know where she is, but she, too, appears to be okay. Back to the question of ZMapp. Do they know for sure that ZMapp is what made them well?
No, that's very unclear, just because even without the drug, during this current outbreak, the recovery rate is about 45%, and most of those people have not received any drug treatment. And so, you know, blood transfusions, rehydration, electrolytes, antibiotics, all of those have contributed to natural recovery without medicines. Without these experimental medicines. So it's very unclear whether or not ZMapp was the contributing factor or whether the supportive care, the very intensive supportive care from Emory Hospital was the factor.
What have you heard and what did Dr. Ridmer say today about the difference between what's happened in Atlanta and what's going on in West Africa, where the disease seems to be out of control?
Well, you have to realize, you know, in a country like Liberia, you know, there's only about 50 medical doctors, licensed doctors, who are practicing in the country. Obviously, there are lots of nurses, and there's a lot of aid workers, and Doctors Without Borders is also providing some support, but it's a very impoverished healthcare system. So, obviously, with Emory Hospital's vast resources, they were able to provide the best possible care possible for Dr. Brantley.
Dr. Ridmer said today that he's concerned about infrastructure. There is concern about infrastructure in Africa. What does he mean by that, in addition to the lack of medical personnel?
Well, personnel is obviously an issue. A lot of healthcare workers have been afraid to come back to work because they don't want to become infected. A lot of the doctors and nurses have been affected by Ebola themselves. But in addition to that, there's also an issue of supplies. They need personal protective equipment so that they don't become infected. They need gloves. There's a huge shortage of general supply needed for the medical workers there.
And there are concerns about the ethical use of experimental drugs. I understand the World Health Organization is going to have a panel about that in early September.
Well, actually, they already had an ethical panel earlier this month just to discuss whether it's ethical to use these experimental medicines. The upcoming meeting will examine in more detail the actual drugs themselves that have been developed by various companies, biotech companies, mostly in the U.S. and Canada.
All right. Makiko Kitamura in London for Bloomberg News. Many thanks to you.
Thank you.
In a moment, arrest records and the expanding movement to ban the box on To The Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. The crime wave of the 1990s led to a crackdown, sometimes called broken windows, featuring increased arrests, often for minor infractions, sometimes for no real infractions at all. The result, almost one-third of all Americans, 77 million people, have been arrested. This week, The Wall Street Journal published an article headlined, "As Arrest Records Rise, Americans Find Consequences Can Cost a Lifetime." John Emshwiler was a co-author of that article. John, good to have you on our program.
My pleasure, Warren. Thank you.
Tell us why that headline. What does that mean?
Well, we started seeing some of these numbers about the very large number of people who have criminal records, arrest records. And we started talking to folks around the country to sort of see, well, what is the impact of all that? And as we discovered, there was potentially a very large impact for many people, particularly in the internet age when records are so much more available online. Even if the records are no longer accurate or outdated, that we decided we should probably do a story on this. It was sort of one of those things that comes after, you know, decades of work in the country. There was a crime wave, as you mentioned, that there was that state, local, federal officials decided had to be dealt with, the public had decided had to be dealt with, and it had a lot of success, but it's also had consequences, and that's sort of what the story is about, looking at some of the consequences.
Tell us more about outdated, inaccurate records, sometimes records of people who never were charged after they were arrested.
Right. You'll get people that get an arrest, and they'll come down to the police station, get booked, and that'll become a public record in many places. And then, you know, there'll be sort of events after that. Sometimes they'll just, in many cases, the case gets dropped because they decided there's not enough to charge them on. Other times they'll get charged, but it'll, along the system, will somehow get dropped after the charges are filed because the DA decides not to pursue the case. And then in some cases, you'll go and get either acquitted at trial or you'll have a plea bargain and get convicted. But what happens often now is people can harvest arrest records off the public record, and you'll see websites. They call them mugshot websites now, and they have different names. And they'll get the arrest records, but they'll often won't get the follow-up to say, okay, the person was never charged. So, you know, one thing that people can run into is that people will look up online and find they have an arrest, but not find out that the arrest didn't lead anywhere. It was a mistaken identity or, you know, one of a number of different alternatives. So there's this whole issue of, you know, completeness and accuracy of records that linger out there in the public.
When we talk about 77 million people being arrested, almost a third of the people in the United States, what percentage of those fall into the categories that you're just describing?
Well, it's hard to get precise numbers about all those things, but some of the studies that we've seen, there's a fairly substantial percentage of arrests that don't lead to prosecutions. I mean, they don't have those kind of records that we saw nationally, but it's not an inconsiderable number of people who have, you know, something less than a conviction, but they still have a criminal record.
And you talk to a lot of people who have struggled to clear their names, and it has been very difficult and very expensive to do that.
It can be. I mean, it used to be you'd have a run-in with the law in the sort of the pre-internet age, and the record might be available at the local police station or the courthouse. But now you can sit anywhere in the world, obviously, and go on to online and find this stuff. And so people, when they're confronting this, let's say it's come up when they're applying for a job or applying for a loan or applying for public assistance of some sort or a professional license, and they have to then sort of say, how do I cleanse the record? Let's say I was arrested, but it was a mistaken identity, or they dropped the charges. Then you start saying, well, there's this website that has it, but then there's sometimes just not that website, but two or three or four dozen other websites. And some of these websites have been charging people several hundred dollars, sometimes more, to say, if you want your record expunged from our website, pay us this amount of money. And some people have paid to one or more websites, only to find other websites pop up 3, 4, 5 days later with the same information. It's hard to know whether they're connected to the first website, independent. A lot of these websites seem to be based overseas, having representatives in places like China or Eastern Europe. So it's nearly impossible sometimes to even find out who owns the particular website that is carrying information about you that might be inaccurate.
So inaccuracy, cases that weren't ever charged, even a case of mistaken identity you discovered, and how very difficult it is. Tell us a little bit more about the mistaken identity one. I think our listeners would want to hear about that.
Yeah, there was a gentleman named Jose Gabriel Hernandez who was arrested for sexually assaulting two young girls, a pretty terrible crime. The police came in, you know, knocked on his door while he was having dinner, came in, arrested him while he was with his family, got hauled out. It turns out that they had the wrong Jose Hernandez. In fact, as it turned out, the Jose Hernandez, who actually was did that crime, didn't look very much at all like the Jose Hernandez who was arrested. But before they sort of sorted that out, Mr. Hernandez was stuck in jail. I think he had a $150,000 bond, you know, because sexually assaulting two young girls is a pretty serious crime. He had to come up then with, he couldn't come up with $150,000, but he borrowed from friends and family, I think maybe his employer, and scraped together about $22,000, which is enough to pay a bail bondsman, his 15% to put up the bond so he could get out of jail. But bail bondsmen don't pay that money back, obviously, that's their fee. So subsequently, Mr. Hernandez's name was cleared, And so he's, you know, he's out of jail and he's not going to be charged, but he's out $22,000+ that he now owes and is still paying back. And I think he does still, you know, worry that his arrest can be sitting out there in cyberspace in places he doesn't even know about. And, you know, so he's sitting there both in debt and wondering, you know, as I move through my life, how is this arrest that was, you know, by all agreement, the authorities, him, everybody says they had the wrong person. How is this arrest going to stay with me?
John Emswiler, once again, investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Daryl Atkinson is a staff attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, but it was not easy for him to get that position. Daryl Atkinson, thank you very much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me.
You had an experience very much relevant to what we're talking about. You were, in fact, charged and convicted, and you did do some time. Tell us what it was for and what happened after that.
In 1996, I pled guilty to a first-time nonviolent drug crime. I spent 40 months in prison under a mandatory minimum sentence in the state of Alabama in their Department of Corrections. I went into the Department of Corrections with a high school diploma. I came out with a high school diploma. Alabama wasn't nearly as progressive as some states in offering post-secondary relief options. And since my release, I've been able to achieve a certain degree of success. I've been able to obtain my associate's degree, my bachelor's degree, my law degree, and I'm licensed to practice law in Minnesota and North Carolina. And I tell that story not to add any kudos to me or data boys for what I've been able to accomplish. I tell that story to illustrate the human capacity of people who we're putting in cages every day. And I also tell that story to illustrate what can happen in a person's life if they have the proper support system. Now, everyone isn't going to have the kind of family or community that I had to return to that could provide me food, clothing, and shelter without those immediate reentry pressures pressing down upon me. That's why it's important that we in civil society and government and private industry, our NGOs, create secondary support systems so more people can be successful. We do that with the programs we develop, but we also do that with the policies that we think are good policies that create an environment where people can be successful. So policies like Bandbox, policies like sealing laws or expungement laws when it comes to criminal record history, and also limitations on who can see criminal record history from the very beginning.
Ban the box. That's the movement to get rid of the box on the application form, whatever it is you're applying for, that says, have you ever been arrested? Tell us, if you were, a little bit more about your own experience and the kind of rejection you had because of your criminal record.
Sure. And just as a point of clarity, you know, the ban the box slogan is not the most accurate because it does not prohibit an employer from doing the background check. It just delays when that happens in the employment process. So I just wanted to make sure that that point is clear for our listeners.
We will clarify that. Go ahead.
With regards to, you know, the barriers that I face, my driver's license was automatically suspended as a result of my drug crime. I was denied federal financial student aid, denied admittance into undergraduate institution and numerous law schools, even though I had an excellent academic record, and turned away from a number of different jobs. They never tell you explicitly that you didn't get the job because of your criminal background. You just never get a call back once you check that box on the employment application. And, you know, after a number of rejections, people start getting the message that it's their criminal history.
First time drug possession, nonviolent crime, mandatory minimum sentence in Alabama. How long was it before you could get started on the remarkable career you described?
You know, once I was released, I began piecing my life together. And like I said, I had the necessary support system to facilitate that successful reintegration. But, you know, I think my story really points to some of the insanity that this country has been engaging in its war on drugs on a number of different fronts. One, the judge had no discretion to downwardly depart from the sentence. You know, I had college professors write letters, because I was in college at the time, I had college professors write letters on my behalf to help me to avoid a prison sentence, but the judge's hands were tied, and that's what mandatory minimums do. They don't allow any discretion for the ultimate decision maker, which is the judge. In addition, you know, at some point in this country, we have to begin treating at least drug crimes as public health issues and not criminal justice issues. We are criminalizing people because they have chronic illness and that they can't get well. So I think, you know, there are a number of different lessons that could be potentially learned from an individual story like mine that could be extrapolated and applied to the broader American criminal justice system.
Well, our focus here, though, is on this Ban the Box movement, and you've said that it's not exactly what it seems. It is now in 12 states and 60 cities, as I understand it, and other states are seriously considering it. Even Texas is one of those. So it delays the process in some way. How does it do that?
So I can use as a case study what we were able to achieve in Durham, North Carolina. Durham City and Durham County passed administrative policies that so-called banned the box. They delayed the question until later on in the employment process.
So it's not on the form anymore.
It's not on the initial application. It's not asked during the interview process. In the county and city of Durham, you are given a conditional offer of employment before a background check is done. So all of your skills and qualifications are assessed. And then once that happens and you're given a conditional offer of employment, the background check is then triggered. Once that happens, the individual applicant can check the accuracy of the record. They have 10 days to submit evidence of rehabilitation. And the hiring authority has to establish a direct relationship between the underlying criminal offense and the prospective job. So, for example, if I have a past criminal history of embezzlement and I'm applying to be the comptroller of the city or the county, there's obviously a direct relationship between that underlying crime and that prospective job. So that makes the criminal history more relevant in the determination of risk of whether I can handle the job responsibilities associated with that particular job.
Does this only apply to public employment?
Yes. Right now, it only applies to public employment in Durham City and county. After we passed our policy, six other jurisdictions across the state of North Carolina passed similar policies, and now we're gearing up for a statewide campaign in 2015. What's notable about the Durham experience is that we've been able to accumulate empirical data since the policies were passed, both at the city and the county level. At the city level, the hiring rate for people with records has gone up every single year since the policy has passed. The first year, the hiring rate for people with records was about 2.2%. The next year, it went up to 4.5%. In 2013, 9% of people with criminal records were 9% of the total hires that the city made were people with criminal records. And this year, 15% of the total hires that the city of Durham has made has been people with criminal records.
Has there been any incident of a terrible mistake having been made?
Well, and that's the point that I was getting to. What's most notable about that, there's been no increases in workplace crime. So we aren't taking a public safety hit, and we're getting people who have, you know, disadvantaged records back to work and being back producers and integral members of our society.
Okay, thank you. Again, Darrell Atkinson is staff attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. We'll continue our conversation with him, with John Emshweiler of the Wall Street Journal, and with others as well. We're going to hear in a moment from an employer who has something to say with regard to the extension of the Ban the Box idea to the private sector. Later on today's Talking Point, the masked executioner of James Foley had a London accent. We'll hear about Islamic terrorism homegrown in Britain. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Ollie back with To the Point, talking today about the 77 million people who've been arrested since the 1990s in the United States, roughly a third of the population of the United States, and what it means when they are never charged or when they are acquitted, or even in the case of Darrell Atkinson with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, when they have pled guilty but have been able, through a great struggle, to go on and have successful careers. John Emshweiler, quickly back to you with the Wall Street Journal. How often is it now, given the availability of these arrest records that you described in such detail, how often is it that, is there an increase in employers and landlords and bankers and others going to those records and rejecting people because they have been arrested?
Well, as far as an increase, hard to measure. We got one estimate from Human Resources Association that about 68% of employers in the survey they did do background checks of some sort and another. I think as Daryl pointed out that routinely, if you're doing a background check and you see something you don't like, generally the first thing you do is just don't call the person. So, you know, these people, if you're waiting with an application, you may just might not hear back, and you'll never know it was because they hit something on a criminal background check of an arrest or whatever.
You'd never know if it was a mistaken identity.
You wouldn't know if it's mistaken identity. You wouldn't know if it was just some, you know, something you could have cleared up in 5 minutes or 2 minutes of conversation. Because employers, they have to walk a fine line, I think, because there is guidance from the federal government, you know, about you shouldn't, certainly you shouldn't treat an arrest as evidence of guilt. I mean, after all, there is a presumption of innocence in the American judicial system. At least people we talk to ever hear anybody say, well, I was told by my employer I was let go because of, you know, they saw an arrest record. I wasn't hired because of that, because, you know, I think employers understandably would worry about then possibly being open to legal action against them by somebody saying, well, that's discriminatory and illegal.
Okay. Again, John Emshweiler with the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth Melito is Senior Executive Counsel for the National Federation of Independent Businesses, represents a good number of businesses, 350,000 small and independent companies throughout the United States. Ms. Melito, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Warren, for having me on today.
As we heard from Daryl Atkinson, there have been ban-the-box efforts with regard to public employment. There also are places in some of the 12 states and 60 cities that have these laws, which also apply to private employment, and he says they're going to try to get that on the ballot in North Carolina. What concerns do you have about that?
Well, the ban-the-box policy, I would say, is not good for all employers or all industries. And as I, you know, repeat over and over again, my mantra is kind of one size doesn't fit all when it comes to employment legislation. Just as generally, legislation that prohibits inquiries into criminal histories until after a conditional job offer has been made can be very problematic, particularly for the smaller businesses that I represent. I mean, the average NFIB member has under 10 employees. 90% of our members have fewer than 20 employees. And what this means is that these businesses do not have a dedicated professional human resource employee, much less an in-house counsel, to kind of navigate through these ever-changing federal, state, and local employment laws and regulations. And so this means that the hiring practices, anything related to HR employment, is oftentimes handled by the business owner in a small business. And in certain businesses, safety is paramount. They're protecting people. They're protecting properties. They may be, you know, if we're talking about a contractor, they're sending their employees into private residences with, you know, potentially vulnerable populations, elderly, disabled, and they need to have confidence in their employees. The employer is assuming all the risk, and one of the ways they can minimize that risk is by doing a background check and by carefully screening who they are hiring and who they're sending into your home.
The question raised by John Emshweiler was, do they really carefully screen, or do they, in fact, once they see somebody has been arrested in the past, simply not consider that person for employment?
Well, what I, you know, a big thing at my job is ensuring that my members, and I think it was John, too, that mentioned, you know, the federal guidance on the use of background checks. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission just within the last year issued new guidelines on using criminal history. And I am very, you know, careful when I talk with my members about this to make sure they understand that individualized assessments are appropriate in most instances. You know, we're talking about consideration of the seriousness of the offense, the time elapsed since the offense, and the relevance of the crime to the job being sought. And I thought, you know, Daryl gave a very nice example there of somebody's, you know, applying for a comptroller position and they were convicted of embezzlement. So that's where, you know, this individualized assessment is very appropriate. And, you know, a business owner should not be discounting anybody or really even inquiring about arrests. You know, it's the convictions that you want to be looking at, not arrest records.
On the other hand, isn't it much easier for a business owner whom, as you pointed out, doesn't have a human resources director or an attorney to help get through the bureaucracy or the legalities? Simply to say, look, if somebody's been arrested, I'm not going to deal with that person, and there's no way you can prove that that's happened. Isn't it likely that people would do that?
I mean, in theory, yes, but this goes back to, you know, there is guidance out there. The EEOC does have a position on that. And there are, you know, discrimination laws and regulations already in place that prohibit job selection procedures, that have a discriminatory disparate impact. So there is EEOC guidance, existing guidance out there that business owners should be following and should be heeding. And they should not be outright, in most instances, just discounting somebody because they have a conviction, and certainly not because they have an arrest.
Elizabeth Melito, excuse me. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
I'm just going to remind our listeners, you're the Senior Executive Counsel for the National Federation of Independent Business, and take the opportunity to introduce Robert Brehm at the University of South Carolina, where he is a professor of criminology and criminal justice. He studied arrests, particularly of young people. Robert Brehm, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What do you say about Ban the Box?
Well, I think that I would echo some of what Mr. Atkinson said about Ban the Box, that, you know, it's a measure that is going to be useful in terms of keeping someone from being necessarily screened out of a job before they've had a chance to have other qualities about their qualifications examined. So it's useful in that respect, but on the other hand, most times when people say ban the box, there's still a mechanism by which the criminal history records can be searched for that individual.
How do you mean, because of the various websites we heard about earlier?
Well, there are websites, there are companies, vendors that will conduct criminal record searches that are thorough, that will try to uncover things that might not be obvious from a simple web search. So, yeah, there are a number of ways that companies or employers could do more extensive criminal history record checking that would go beyond someone just saying on an application whether they've had involvement in the criminal justice system.
There are a lot of different ban the box statutes on the books, as I understand it, and municipal ordinances as well. Do they differ with regard to what they say in terms of penalties if, in fact, you're supposed to ban the box, but nonetheless you find some other way to do a background check, very particularly to find out if somebody's been arrested?
Well, I think that there are many ban the box procedures, and there are many initiatives that are being considered right now for how ban the box might be implemented in this or that jurisdiction. So it's really, really hard to make a summary, summary statement about what's going on, you know, everywhere. There are varying penalties for it. There are varying things that people mean when they say ban the box. So it's really kind of a catch-all term at this point.
To what extent does research show criminal records can predict future behavior?
Well, we have a strong set of research findings going back for decades now that tell us very clearly that an old criminal history is much less predictive of future crimes than a more recent criminal history. So, you know, an old saying among criminologists is past behavior is often a good predictor of future behavior. But that turns out to be too simplistic, because old past behavior is actually far less predictive of future behavior than recent past behavior.
So what about the employers who might be likely to call people or to reject people who have criminal records? Do they know that?
I think there's variability in how much knowledge there is about that. I think criminologists know it. I think a lot of social scientists know it. I think a lot of policy makers know it. The counsel you just had on a moment ago, she recognized that when she said that folks should consider how long it's been since the last offense. And so I think there is some knowledge of it. I'm not sure how knowledgeable individual employers are about it. So the question would be, when an employer is faced with someone with a criminal history, do they automatically exclude when they know there's a criminal history, or do they then go to the second question, which is the second question, third question, how long ago has it been, what was the offense, what's the evidence of rehabilitation, what's the relationship to the job? Those are all questions that might be asked after the threshold question is asked.
Back to the very beginning of our program, how much do we know about the increase in arrest rates and how often arrests become convictions?
Well, many arrests do not become convictions, and we know a lot of people get arrested. And we know a lot of those arrest records make their way into databases that are accessible to the public. So we've done research that looks at surveys of the general population between the ages of 12 and 16 in the mid-90s, and they've been followed forward. The people in the sample we studied have been followed forward since then. And what we find is that about by age 23, about a third of the population has been arrested at least once for something other than a non-traffic offense. And we have some reasons to believe that's, that number is higher than it was in the past. But one of the things one has to remember with this is we don't have a good system in the United States for tracking the fraction of the population that gets arrested. So we don't have systematic long-term data on that. So a lot of folks are getting arrested, and our analysis shows that. But our analysis is based on surveys, and so need to be clear that we're not looking at individual criminal history records. We're asking people to self-report whether they've been arrested or not.
Back to the question of people who have, in fact, committed crimes and been released after whatever sentence they've had to serve, what's the relationship between employment for them and public safety?
Well, we have a lot of evidence, first of all, that says that when folks who have a criminal history and they try to get a job, they actually do run into systematic difficulties. We have audit studies that tell us very clearly that people who have criminal histories are significantly less likely to get callbacks from potential employers. So first and foremost, we must recognize that the criminal history creates obstacles to getting employment. Second of all, we do have some evidence that suggests there is a correlation between one's securing gainful employment, good employment, and avoiding future criminality. Most of that evidence is correlational, though, in the sense that it's possible there are other things that could explain some of that relationship. So, for example, maybe the most motivated ex-offenders are more likely to seek employment, and because they're more motivated, they're also less likely to recidivate. So there's some rival hypotheses, and it's correlational evidence, but nonetheless, there is a lot of that kind of evidence out there, so it's suggestive.
So those people with criminal records who are employed have less recidivism, but we don't know that that's the cause.
We don't know for sure that that's the cause, but there is a correlation. That's right.
Robert Bram at the University of South Carolina. I want to go back to John Emshweiler with the Wall Street Journal. You've reported recently that in Indiana there is an effort, I don't know how far it's gone, maybe you can tell us, to make it easier to simply expunge arrest records.
Yes, there's various efforts going on around the country. Indiana passed a law fairly recently, I believe, to try to make it, give more protection for that. State of California, I think Jerry Brown just signed a law last week that would essentially make it illegal for these so-called mugshot websites to charge to have information taken off their websites. So I think there are various movements going on around the country to provide more protection to people from prying eyes, you might say. It raises some interesting questions. I mean, being a journalist, we think about this more, perhaps. You know, we tend to live off public records. So on the one hand, you know, we love the idea of everything being public. Reporting on a story like this starts raising questions and saying, well, should someone who has a mistaken record or an incomplete record have to be saddled with that? And if so, and if not, how do you deal with that? And I'm not sure we have answers completely to that yet that will always completely, you know, jibe with the First Amendment.
So we'll watch for the consequences in Indiana, too, of that law. Elizabeth Melito, do you worry about that?
Somewhat I do, but I mean, I think overall, again, you know, the members that I represent really are striving to provide a workplace that's free from discrimination. And again, they're focusing on the convictions. In many instances, they are using an outside vendor. So, I mean, a lot of the members I talk with, too, they're not themselves Googling and going on these websites.
Sure.
They're using an outside vendor to do their background checks. You know, with regards to the application, what they're asking on the application is, have you been convicted of, you know, anything, and then, you know, listed and when it happened, and, you know, explain the circumstances surrounding it. And then that's when then, you know, businesses should be making that, you know, individualized assessment, looking at the three factors. And then in some instances, you know, it is a good policy to allow the employer to abort an applicant's candidacy if there exists a legitimate business reason to do so.
And Darrell Atkinson, you don't fundamentally disagree with that. You just think it should be more difficult and that the process ought to be more laborious for the employer. Is that right? We don't have a lot of time left.
Well, I guess laborious might not be the way I would characterize
it. Wrong way to put it. Illegal.
Well, just more principled. They just do it in a principled way. And ultimately, Warren, this comes down to, what kind of country do we want to have? We have 77 million people whose record is in a database. And we have exhaustive research to show that even an arrest record, not just a conviction record, limits access and opportunity to jobs.
Okay.
So do we want to have a country where we can have access and opportunity available to all of our citizens, or don't we? And if we do, we can craft policies that do that in a principled way that provides access and opportunity, but also offers the employer a safety net to where they aren't putting people at risk.
All right. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're just simply going to have to leave it at that. Thank you very much. Darrell Atkinson with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, Elizabeth Melito with the National Federation of Independent Business, Robert Graham at the University of South Carolina, and John Emschweiler with the Wall Street Journal. In the video of the journalist James Foley's beheading, his masked executioner speaks with a London accent. That brought Prime Minister David Cameron home from a family vacation, who called the killing shocking and depraved. We'll have more about how Britons are reacting in a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with today's Talking Point. Prime Minister Cameron held emergency meetings at 10 Downing Street yesterday to discuss the involvement of British citizens with the Islamic State. Here's what he told the BBC.
We have not identified the individual responsible on the video, but from what we've seen, it looks increasingly likely that it is a British citizen. Now, this is deeply shocking, but we know that far too many British citizens have travelled to Iraq and travelled to Syria to take part in extremism and violence.
Griff Whitty is reporting from London for The Washington Post. Hi, Griff. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
Are they really trying to identify this individual?
Well, they're trying to do so. We assume that they're working very vigorously to do so. They tell us that there are efforts underway involving foreign intelligence, domestic intelligence, the police services. They have a good bit of information to go on, obviously. The executioner spoke at length in the video. His voice is clearly recognizable for anyone who might know him, and for anyone who perhaps has been listening to his phone calls from Syria back to the UK or perhaps within Syria, the intelligence agencies can possibly make a match that way. But the question is then, once you've figured out who he is, what you do with that information, which is something that I think the British authorities are going to be struggling with in the coming days, even if they are able to figure out who he is.
Why does it appear that the Islamic State would use a person with a British accent under these circumstances?
Well, I think the reason is that they knew that it would elevate the propaganda value of the video if there was a Brit who was speaking unaccented English. He was a fluent English speaker, and he was beheading an American. That's something that deeply shocked Britons, deeply shocked Americans, deeply shocked people all over the world. Of course, Britain jihadists have been carrying out atrocities for a very long time in Syria and in Iraq. This is not a new thing, but most of their violence has been directed toward fellow Muslims, Syrians and Iraqis who live in those countries. What was unusual about this video was that it was a Westerner, a Briton, apparently killing an American.
Apparently, they haven't gone all that far to conceal their identity. Elsewhere, it's been reported that this person is known as one of the British Beatles.
Well, the information that has come out so far about the identity of the executioner, it's not been a lot of information, but what has come out seems to have come from a group of European hostages who were held by this group and were released earlier this year. They had been held apparently in the same location as Jim Foley and were held by the same individuals. And so they provided a little bit of information to principally to the Guardian newspaper, which has reported, as you say, that there were three British jailers who were in charge of the Western hostages, and that either they referred them to themselves as in that way with the names of the Beatles, or that's how the hostages took to referring to them. But in any case, we don't know much beyond that about their identities. We don't know real names. If the British intelligence services know real names, and they may at this point, they haven't released them publicly yet.
There was, of course, a threat against President Obama or directed at him with regard to American behavior and the airstrikes. What other reasons are there for Islamic Jihad to release a video like this?
Well, I think it perhaps is a recruitment tool for them. They release a video like this, and it gets a lot of attention. And it's something that obviously it's abhorrent to anyone who, you know, is watching this and who has a heart. But for people who are inclined already toward this kind of deeply, deeply disturbing behavior, a video like this holds some appeal. And it's possible that they were releasing this video and trying to provoke a reaction from the West. It's also possible they were releasing this video and trying to get more people from the West to come and join their fight.
How concerned are the British, Prime Minister Cameron and others, about the recruitment aspect of this and about people in the areas where the Islamic State is now located coming back to Britain?
It's been the number one security priority of the British government and of governments across Europe for quite some time now. British authorities have been raising the alarm and calling attention to the fact that there are thousands of Westerners who have gone to fight in Syria and now also in Iraq, and that some of them inevitably have been returning home. About 250 Britons, it's estimated, have gone to Syria and have come back to the UK. Now, some of them came back and were disenchanted with their experiences. They went there and they found that they went there perhaps with the intention of fighting the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and they found that when they arrived there, they weren't doing that. They were fighting fellow rebels. They were killing fellow Muslims, and so they came back to Britain, perhaps disappointed by that experience and perhaps dissuaded from radicalism. But there are also Britons who have returned, no doubt, who are even more radicalized. And the real concern of British authorities, the real concern of authorities across the West, is that some of these people are going to return and they're going to have the goal of carrying out an attack in the West, in London, in Washington, wherever it may be, wherever they're able.
There appear to be fewer Americans than there are Britons now who are engaged in this behavior. Is that right?
That's right, and it's something that really concerns European authorities. It's not only Britons, but it's really people across Europe have gone and joined this fight in large numbers, and that's of grave concern to officials here. It's very easy to get from Europe to Syria. It doesn't take much more than jumping on a plane, flying to Turkey, and then crossing the border by land. It can be done very easily, very quickly, very inexpensively. And so it's been a major draw, even more so than previous conflicts, than the Afghanistan War in the 80s, for instance, or even the Iraq War, the original Iraq War in 2003. You're seeing a much larger flow of jihadis at this point into the Middle East from Europe.
And I understand there is a training program of a kind, a sort of preparation that goes on when they're still in Britain. Is that right?
Well, it's not exactly known. I'm sure that is something that intelligence services are paying very, very close attention to. But they have their eye on these people. They know who they are. They watch them very carefully. A number of them have been arrested. But at this point, there are so many of them that it becomes very difficult for security services here to keep tabs on all of them.
All right, Griff Whitty, once again, a London bureau chief for The Washington Post. Thank you very much for being on our program.
It's good to be here, Warren. Thanks.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.